the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast on the CBP Media Network. My name is Joey. I'm here with yet again another handsome guy, not Len though. It's Dennis Porter, co-founder, CEO, Satoshi Action Fund. Buddy, first of all, thank you for making time. What's going on? How are you? Are you in a cold state, a warm state? Talk to me about what's going on where you are.
Thank you for that great introduction. And by the way, that intro song, man, got me hyped just listening to it. So next time I launch a podcast, I'm going to go with the deep beats.
Trap drums.
Trap drums. Just get hyped right before the show. No, thanks for having me on, Joey. It's moderate temperatures here right now. I'm in Oregon, so sometimes it's cold, sometimes it's rainy, sometimes it's hot. We get a good mixture of weather over here, but not being frozen out too badly right now.
Good. I'm glad to hear that because there are some states that are, and I'm sure we'll actually talk about one state in particular and its power grid. But before we start, Dennis, a lot of people know you from many of the different things you've done in the Bitcoin space over the last few years. But I think, you know, it'd be best to give a sort of a brief 30,000 foot. How did you get into Bitcoin? What was your background before Bitcoin? What was your kind of origin story?
Yeah, man, for sure. You know, it's been a fun ride. I've been waiting to jump into the public arena for Bitcoin for some time. I joined the Bitcoin ranks in 2017, really started to study and research it after I discovered Bitcoin, was kind of hooked almost immediately. I wasn't one of those people that, learned about it and said no. In fact, I learned about it and said, I'm going to disprove that this thing actually does what people say it does. So immediately set out to do that. Lo and behold, I had proved myself right in some ways. But in that process of trying to prove my friend wrong about how this technology operates, I just became completely obsessed. You know, started reading Mastering Bitcoin from Andreas Antonopoulos. All the books that were available or possible to read back then, I was immediately digesting them. There was not nearly as much content as there is today. So we're lucky these days to have so many great shows like yours and others and so many great books that we can read that really help us to understand this technology. So 2017, studying Bitcoin, researching Bitcoin, tried to mine Bitcoin, taught myself how to do electrical work, taught myself how to mine Bitcoin, and did that for a little while. Wanted to go all in, but decided, the market kind of started to waver. So I was like, all right, this is not the time to YOLO into Bitcoin mining. I don't quite understand this market good enough. Tried to teach myself to code. Also quickly remembered why I dropped out of high school and why I dropped out of college. I do not like to learn new languages. I don't like to sit down and learn from a textbook. So it was very difficult for me. So I decided to put the pause on it and just wait till something better came along. Lo and behold, that took several years. Decided to get a little bit into the political space. I had a long dream of wanting to do work in the political arena and started doing that for a couple years. And then COVID hit and we were all kind of hunkered up in our homes. And that's when Saylor started coming out talking about Bitcoin. And I was just like, oh man, this thing's about to pop again. I got to do something. So that's when I jumped on Clubhouse, jumped on Twitter Spaces, and the rest is history.
So you did some stuff. You had I got to be honest with you, the number of times I've been in group chats over the years and had someone just snipe in a breaking, all caps about some story, that's basically yours now, right? That's your corner, your breaking corner. And you also did some stuff with Compass. Whit Gibbs was on this program many moons ago. So that's a company we're familiar with. You've got quite a varied background. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the politics side today, the mining side today, things like that. But guys like you, I think that's a story that's more common in Bitcoin than many people realize. Formal education aside, there's people who are interested in this thing for some reason, right? You kind of describe it there. Something's going to happen here. I got to get involved. What do I do? Well, I got this set of skills, this set of expertise. I'm going to do it. Now, you started Satoshi Action Fund. And this to me is an interesting thing. I will admit that, probably a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I was on this team of, we don't need regulators. In fact, we need regulators to go away and let this thing flourish. I've since changed my view and we'll get into that. And you can talk to me a bit about why maximalists should take that point of view. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts. But first, tell me why Satoshi Action Fund. And, maybe if you could, Dennis, you guys have a really nice angle on proof of work. It's mining and proof of work that you're interested in more than, quote unquote, Bitcoin regulation. So talk to me a bit about the origin story and why that angle.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a reason why I decided to focus on Bitcoin mining. One is it's because it's one of my favorite components of Bitcoin. It was the very first thing that I was attracted to about the technology. You know, outside of all the other incredible opportunities that this technology provides to developing nations and those that don't have financial services, like what's the very next best thing? And that's Bitcoin mining by a long shot. In fact, some argue that well, I kind of almost argue that Bitcoin mining might have a bigger impact in the near term than Bitcoin, the asset, on our everyday lives. And that's because Bitcoin mining as a technology is having incredibly profound impacts on the way that we distribute our energy and the way that we manage our energy systems. It's also having an incredibly positive impact on the environment through methane mitigation. But at the same time, we're hearing these stories from the news and the media that, oh, Bitcoin mining is bad and it's boiling the oceans. And it's, you know, we had a guy on ACLU guy up there in Montana opposing our policy that we were working for because he said people are dying. They're dying in the hot aisle. I was blown away. I wish you could have seen the camera angle of my face because I was just like, what? Like just straight. Like I try to keep a straight face the whole time. There's a couple times where you see me kind of look up a little bit, but when he said that, I just couldn't help myself. So you have these just really frivolous and like ridiculous attacks being lobbied against Bitcoin, and in some ways, it's very much just the opposite of what is going on. You know, we are seeing potentially, maybe not, we don't have proof yet, but I guarantee you, we will have proof that Bitcoin mining will have resulted in lives being saved because the grid didn't collapse. You could probably start to make that argument. I don't think we have the data to support it. But in Texas, for instance, when the grid was starting to be strained there, not only last summer, but this recent winter, 1,500 megawatts of power were returned to the grid during a peak demand moment. That's enough power to put into context. That's enough power to heat 1.5 million small homes. That's a lot of homes. And also, if you take that power and convert it to something different, just for context, that's enough power to keep 300 large hospitals online. So it's an incredibly large amount of power that's being returned at the moment that matters the most. So that's part of the reason why, those are the two big reasons why I'm here to defend Bitcoin mining and advance it. It's an incredibly powerful technology and is up against some of the worst and most, I would say, problematic narratives that we've seen in the Bitcoin space to date, right? You don't see a lot of people fighting against Bitcoin, but there is a lot of attacks going on Bitcoin mining right now from environmental communities, which a last comment there, I'll say, I really think that we can get those that care a lot about the environment and those that care a lot about clean air and emissions to be on Team Bitcoin.
This is a common refrain from both mining enthusiasts, I should say all three, mining enthusiasts, people in your shoes or adjacent shoes that are pushing for a narrative shift, which we'll get into in a second, and also from competent public and private miners. It seems like this is the logical next step. The Bitcoin Mining Council talks a bit about this as well. And I want to get into that a bit. Now, you mentioned there the narrative. Let's talk about what Satoshi Action Fund is doing to shift this narrative to a positive one for miners and for Bitcoin writ large. You talk to a lot of politicians. In fact, if you go to the Satoshi Action Fund page, you will see Dennis. It's basically just, I think it might just be your Instagram posts with various politicians, people of power.
Yeah,
there's
sure.
A lot of ill-fitting suits and people I've seen on TV. And so I'm curious, you know, what when you talk to these politicians, presumably Dennis, when you sit with them, most of them got to be like Bitcoin agnostic, right? They know about it, but they don't really have an opinion one way or the other. So when you talk to them, what's the sort of prevailing mental model when you bring up mining, protecting mining, proof of work, all these things?
Well, it's definitely a different pitch depending on who you're talking to. So if you're talking to somebody who's a Republican versus a Democrat, there's a different angle and a part of the conversation there. It's not vastly different, but it's just there needs to be some consideration with the way you have the conversation. And then also if someone is on the state side versus the federal side as well, those are just completely different conversations. So if you're talking to somebody who's on the federal side, you're talking about, you know, hey, we want to eliminate the unfair taxation on Bitcoin mining. And we want to try to potentially remove capital gains one day. That would be great, right? Like those are all long-term projects that we see in the Bitcoin mining space. There's a few others too. There's things like we've seen recently. There's some banking issues where banks are trying to kick Bitcoin or crypto broadly companies out of the banking system. And so we need to be making sure that we fight back against those efforts. On the state side, though, it's a much more exciting conversation because you're actually pitching the technology in a way where you're saying, this can help you, this can help the people of your state, this can help your energy infrastructure. And we do that by saying, this can provide Bitcoin mining, can provide high-paying jobs, local investment, grid stability, environmental cleanup, and the ability to enhance green and renewable energy projects. And Doesn't matter who you are, what state you're from, whether you're red, whether you're blue, wherever you are on the political spectrum, like everyone agrees that we need those things. So we pitch that story. We explain how it actually accomplishes those things. We have about a 30 to 40 minute briefing that we do. And we've done that briefing for dozens of state policymakers, members of Congress, staffers. In fact, just in like end of last month, we were in DC doing the briefing at the Senate Finance Committee hearing room, which was fortunately set up by Senator Wyden's team. We're really thankful to be working with them. You know, we're hoping to get them closer and closer to doing something solid for the space. You know, these are long-term projects, but ultimately we were glad to see that he was interested to let me come and speak at the Senate Finance Committee hearing room, which is one of the most, I would say, like prestigious committee hearing rooms of the entire Senate, being that the Senate Finance is the most powerful committee, one of the most powerful committees in all of Congress. So very fortunate and thankful again to Senator Wyden's team for that. But what we do is we just walk them through. We say, you know, here's jobs. That's an easy one, right? Like jobs is like, right. You know, there's people, there's technicians, there's electricians, there's people that are managing these operations. And then you jump into kind of the investment and you see companies like Riot spending hundreds of millions of dollars investing in cities like remote and rural cities and economically depressed zones like Corsicana, Texas. You also see CleanSpark converting a former data center from Sprint, which they spent $50 million converting that into a high-tech Bitcoin mining facility where they're doing immersion cooling, very cool stuff. And then we break into the cool, exciting things around how Bitcoin mining impacts the environment, how it helps with renewables, how it helps to mitigate methane, how it helps to mitigate and clean up orphan and abandoned oil wells, and also agriculture as well. We spend a good amount of time there. Then we jump into the, you know, I would say is like the grid stability stuff that everyone is kind of aware of in the space at this point. But so far on the state level, kind of going back to the difference in the conversation is like these state policymakers, they get it. They see the value there and they're willing to pass pro Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining policy because of those stories that we're able to tell.
Yeah, you mentioned a few things there, and I want to pull on a few of those threads. One of them is this 30 to 40 minute briefing, this sort of 4-point, line them up, knock them down. Every state needs this. Every politician wants this on their resume. You guys have on your website something I've not seen too many places. We're big on education here on the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. We always like companies and institutions and groups that have some kind of public-facing resource. And in your case, you kind of have two of them, right? You have one that you share with the public, but is for, I think, politicians, this one pager that's there. And you also have this other thing called a policy model. And so I'm curious, before we get into these sort of four policy pillars that you have on your website, talk to me about why this mechanism, why this policy model? How did you come up with this? Were there different iterations, some hits and misses? This is very unique, I think, as far as things available to the public to consume.
Yeah, I mean, that is accurate. We are one of the first public policy groups in the Bitcoin mining space that produces policy for state policymakers in a way where they can take it and they can kind of convert it to their local laws on the books. So what the process of how policy is crafted and made is basically you have, an organization like ours will draft model policy. And this is just kind of giving a framework for what the policymakers should make their policy look like. Because oftentimes these issues like Bitcoin mining, I mean, this stuff is highly technical. And also policymakers have so many other things to focus on. So they will lean on organizations like ours for ideas. And what we do is we bring them those ideas and then they take that model policy and they craft it into state law through their drafters. They have lawyers that are kind of just on the payroll of the state. They draft it and then they introduce it and then they put it through committee. And then they try to pass it on the House and Senate side and then get it signed by the governor. And also news today, no one else is talking about it because Twitter's down right now. So you're going to be the first one to put it on breaking news. Our Senate bill in Mississippi just passed on the Senate floor. So we have officially passed that on the Senate side there in Mississippi.
So you guys have on your website there, well, at least from what I can tell, four sort of key policy and documents available. One is protections for digital mining. One is microgrid and grid resiliency. One is a Bitcoin mining council resolution. And one is an orphaned well partnership policy. There's probably not four more important narratives in Bitcoin mining than those four. Those are environmental. Those are economic. Those are, you know, all sorts of important both near term and long term for mining. Talk to me a bit about why you guys chose to really go all in on that stuff more than, let's say, I don't know. You know, you talked a bit about capital gains, for example, the Cynthia Lummis bill. You know, that's a good example of something that's got a lot of traction on Twitter, and it's something you guys support, as you mentioned. But your efforts don't seem to be going much to financial regs. Instead, they're going to what I would sort of quantify as or qualify as like energy policy. So why that choice, number one? And number two, talk to me a bit about those four pillars you guys have. I'd like to hear a little bit more about them if you could.
Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed it right on the head, Joey. It's ultimately a lot of Bitcoin policy is energy policy. And there's a reason why we focus on the states as well, because states are where the majority of energy policy takes place. Like, for instance, remember when I was mentioning how, you know, if you're in DC, you're talking about trying to fight back against double taxation, you might be trying to get them to give you grant money, but that's, you're not really hyper-focused on energy policy. Now, there is some long-range stuff that we are going to be working towards in the future. I think in our second phase, which will happen roughly in 2024, you will see us kind of do a little bit more federal work, but it's very limited in scope compared to the state level. The states are where almost all the energy policy takes place, and that's where we focus at so that we can have the greatest impact. The four pieces of policy that we have our orphaned oil well, we have our Bitcoin mining council, what kind of sets up a council for the purposes of studying Bitcoin for the state so that they can return a report to the state. We basically did that in New Hampshire. We didn't pass the bill, but we were asked to be a part of a committee that was in New Hampshire where they studied Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining. And at the end of that governor's report put out by Governor Sununu, they ultimately came to the conclusion that Bitcoin mining is good for the grid, Bitcoin mining is good for renewables. And then they actually directed their own state and said, we should be trying to find out any way possible to integrate Bitcoin mining into the state of New Hampshire's energy infrastructure. So that was huge. So we want to see more states study mining and then come to that conclusion, because pretty much anytime you study Bitcoin mining deeply enough, you're coming to the conclusion that this thing is a great piece of technology and it can help you achieve your energy goals. The other one that we have, so we have orphaned oil well as well, microgrid, the council, and the Digital Protection for Mining Act. That's the one that just passed the Senate floor in Mississippi. It's most likely going to be the easiest to pass bill in the entire country. There are other states that are interested in, for instance, the orphan and abandoned oil well policy, states like Texas, states like Oklahoma, but it's just a little bit more complicated. The same goes for the microgrid policy. Like, some states are not going to want to be doing microgrids. They're going to push back a lot on it. In fact, we've had pushback on that policy in some states. And so we've kind of dialed it back and we're just really focusing on New Hampshire at this moment. Same, you know, oddly enough, I thought the committee would be the easiest, but by far and away, it has been the Digital Protection for Mining Act, because it's ultimately a anti-discrimination bill. Like, we're not asking for any special privileges. We're just asking for you to give us the same standards that are applied to all other businesses. And so it's kind of an easy pill to swallow, like, oh, you don't want to be discriminated against. Fine. Well, we don't do that anyways. I'm like, okay, well, easy thumbs up, vote yes, right? Like, if you already feel like it's a good idea, then, you know, it's kind of easy to pass. But with orphan wells, microgrids, those two are more difficult because it's only simply for the fact that it takes more education and it takes a policymaker and a state and an energy kind of infrastructure that's willing to move in the right direction on those policies. But those are our four pieces of policy. We've had all four of them introduced. So we've had six pieces of policy introduced in five states so far.
That's pretty solid. Do you feel like you have to sort of line up sevens on the slot machine to get some of this stuff introduced? You kind of mentioned it there. You need sort of a favorable landscape as far as the key players. But as you mentioned, you know, if one state starts to look at this stuff a certain way, is that a precedent, given the sort of variance across states, is that precedent really valuable to you guys? Or is there a tendency for states to sort of go the other way and go, well, if New Hampshire did this, I don't think we should do it. New Hampshire's done a lot of things we disagree with, or our state votes blue, they vote red, for example, whatever the case is, right? Lots of different fault lines there. Do you view those precedents as valuable, or do you think that it's just as valuable to sort of sharpen up the presentation and go across the country, as opposed to maybe trying to hit, you know, like one state in one part of the country and then the surrounding states, for example, states that presumably are in similar geographic energy situations as each other?
I mean, it's a great question, and it's something that we think a lot about on how we approach the strategy. For us in the beginning, it really was just, let's go after the low-hanging fruit. Let's go after where we can have the most success in the shortest amount of time in order to be able to get wins on the board for Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining at the legislative level. So for instance, like in New York, you have this moratorium on behind the meter fossil fuel Bitcoin mining, right? Like people started talking about how that will become a blueprint for Bitcoin mining or anti-Bitcoin mining legislation. And what we wanted to do was quickly get our blueprint for pro-Bitcoin mining legislation on the books ASAP, since they've already achieved that success. And oftentimes these things can take a year, even 2 years to get passed. Now we're pretty confident we can get something done this cycle, but your comment that do you got to get all the sevens in a row? Like, yeah, it can very much be like that. And you have to really get everything lined up and make sure people are on board, on your team. But also the benefit of being in the United States is that we have 50 chances instead of in DC, where it's kind of just one shot and anybody can get in. Elizabeth Warren can put up her hand in the Senate and get in your way of an easy passage of a bill. Whereas on the state side, you have 50 chances, and some of these states just like, you know, are ready to go. Like Montana, mm-hmm. they're like ready to go. And we're hoping that they're going to probably be, could possibly be, we'll see, one of the first states in the country to fully pass pro Bitcoin mining legislation. But you really don't know. This stuff can kind of go all sorts of different directions, but we're feeling pretty positive about that state right now.
I'm curious, what is the sort of most common objection you hear from state legislators, from state energy, from state, you know, stakeholders? Because it seems to me, and like you and I agree on this, obviously, we're kind of preaching to the converted here. This is a no-brainer, but there's got to be objections sort of before the ball even gets rolling for this thing to end up as a no for you guys. What are they? I'm curious about that.
You know, oftentimes it's just, you know, the question is, what is Bitcoin, right? Like these people still sometimes haven't had the proper education, but I don't completely fault policymakers. Honestly, they have, especially state policymakers, they have very little time to focus on the policy that they're working on. These state sessions are very short. They can be 2-3 months sometimes. And they have to weigh and understand and research so many different other topics that they're voting on. And so, you know, when they say like, what is Bitcoin? Like, you know, me and you, like you said, preaching to the converted, we're all kind of like, oh my gosh, these people are still asking what is Bitcoin. But the problem really is on a policy side, and this happens in DC too, is that there, like I said, there is just so many other important issues to focus on that, you know, we know that Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining are incredibly, incredibly important, but you're going up against, you know, military budget, you're going up against healthcare budget, you're going up against the southern border. Like these are things that have been critical issues in the eyes of legislators for decades and maybe more than that, right? So trying to get them to focus on your issue is difficult, but it's important. And so what we do, again, is going back to our mandate, Satoshi Action Fund, we don't just pass public policy, we educate. So we spend a lot of time educating policymakers and regulators on the benefits of Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining. And then we turn around and then we try to push them to pass policy. But we're a small team, we're new, and it's going to take a lot of work to pass policy in all 50 states. But there are some states, I think, that are kind of primed and ready to go the right direction after seeing some of the successes that have happened in other states like Texas and Wyoming.
What about the groups who are pushing the opposite story? What about the groups who are pushing back in the way that you are on the other side? They want less Bitcoin mining, or maybe they want proof of stake, Dennis. You know, we've seen proof of stake gather some traction here in the last, you know, 6 months or so. Are you guys concerned about that? What are the strategies they're using? And what is Satoshi Action Fund doing to, I don't want to say overcome, but to challenge those other narratives?
Yeah, so I think that there's something really important to be said about, you know, strategy and how you approach these different organizations that might be combating you. But for now, for us as an organization, what we wanted to do was work really quickly to get wins on the board. Like we have 50 states that have the opportunity to go the right direction on Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining. And if we get too caught up in fighting and spending all of our time and energy and resources in states or with policymakers at the federal level who are opposed to us, then we're going to miss out on opportunities where we could be scoring wins on the board for Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining. Going back to this idea of like state level advocacy, like this is all by design because it's all been done before. I'm not doing anything radically new. Advocacy organization after advocacy organization has come through and use the political system in the United States the way that I'm using it many times before. So we've seen it, for instance, with the marijuana industry in 2010, or is it 2012, excuse me, Oregon and Washington and Colorado had pro-marijuana legislation on the books, and Washington and Colorado passed it that year. A decade later, almost 75% of the country has pro-marijuana legislation on the books, and it's still a federal crime. You still can't get banking. Like, this is, so sometimes I think we take it a little bit for granted. Like, we think, oh, we have it so bad in the Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining space. And I don't want to convince people not to keep going to war, right? And keep fighting for Bitcoin, because this is how we make sure that we win in the United States, because I believe we can. But ultimately, we don't have it that bad. It's not a federal crime. You can still get banking. Hopefully that'll last, right? They're trying to fight us on that as well right now, but you can still get banking. And at the end of the day, you know, Bitcoin is its own bank too. So it's not so bad if you get kicked out of the banking system, in the sense that you're not totally cut off. Obviously that would be a death sentence to some companies, but you do have that backup plan, so to speak, with Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining. But that's the policy kind of approach that we take, state level advocacy. And again, the other thing that I want Bitcoiners to get away from is, like, we like to just say, like, oh, the political system is broken, it doesn't work. It's like, okay, but it might be broken a little bit. It might be a little corrupt. But what you need to do is look at it and understand how it works, and then go and use that system to the benefit of Bitcoin. Like, if you believe in Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining enough, you'll stop complaining about how the system is corrupt and how it doesn't work. And you'll start trying to figure out how to take advantage of that broken system. And fortunately, in that broken system, there is one angle that works really, really well, and that is state level advocacy. You got to go talk to your state policymakers, tell them all about Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining. Hey, if you don't love to educate, if you don't love to spend time with them, that's what Satoshi Action Fund is here for. You know, go and have a conversation with them, get convince them that you're there and you're not going away, and then hand them over to us. And we're the ones that can kind of walk them through the process on education and potentially introducing public policy that supports Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining.
Is there more to say there for the maximalist crowd who is, like you mentioned, sort of vehemently anti-government? And it's not just about mining. It's about, you know, financial regulation. And you mentioned, again, that the taxes, the capital gains minimum and things like that. What other things would you say to a maximalist, Dennis? You did some of it there, but I'm curious if you have any more thoughts on winning over that camp. And I ask because we've seen a discernible uptick in, I don't know what I want to call these people, the sort of, like, you know, I own Bitcoin, but also Ethereum, or I own Bitcoin, but also equities. I own Bitcoin, but I also, you know, work in government or work with government. Someone like you, right? I'm sure you've taken, you know, your fair share of shit over the years for the work you do trying to push policymakers, right? So what is the thing, you know, you would say to the maxis who just don't see any value in the work that you're doing because, you know, government makes everything worse or whatever the argument is, right? These sort of crypto anarchists, often from, you know, often an older vintage than you or I when it comes to their time in Bitcoin. But what would you say to them? What are they missing that you think they should be paying attention to?
Well, I you know, honestly, I think that the kind of this comment that we've been making about Bitcoiners and maximalists not being in favor of, you know, using the government has changed pretty dramatically over the last year and a half. I mean, we have seen some of the most ardent Bitcoiners that are super maxi be into politics and get into the political arena to try to have an impact. So in some ways, I think that that narrative is changing. I think that Bitcoiners see the value of engaging the political system. There's an old saying that in the political space, it says, you might not want to do politics, but politics will do you. And so that basically says, like, you can ignore politics and it can work for you for a long time. In fact, the oil and gas industry will tell you how well that worked out for them. The tech industry will tell you how that worked out for them. And they all thought they're outside of government too. But at the end of the day, nothing, everything that we create is outside government, so to speak, but we are not outside government. Our human bodies still are in this real world, and they can ban Bitcoin. They can ban Bitcoin mining. They can take your Bitcoin. You know, it's like, you can do everything you can to try to stop them. But at the end of the day, like, it's much better if we start to try to figure out how we can work within government to get what we want done quickly enough in a way that is supportive of Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining. And ultimately the narrative, like I said, it's been changing. You're going to have some maxis no matter what, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, we could be walking in a United States that is like so pro Bitcoin. There is freedom abounding in this country, and people will still say it was a mistake to get involved with government because of one regulation that was made. I mean, there's just people that really don't believe in this idea of regulations at all. And at the end of the day, like, that's just not the world we live in. Like, I love some world where we have no regulations, where we, you know, we live in a world where we don't need to have laws, but ultimately we do need to have laws, and we do need to have some sort of framework for how people should live. That's how humans have lived since the beginning of time. I think that we've definitely gotten a little bit too much into too much regulation and too much control. You know, we need to take a little step back from that. But again, that's why I like the state level approach, right? Because the state level approach is like jobs, you know, protecting Bitcoin mining, orphaned oil wells, let's clean it up. On the federal side, they're like, oh, let's come cramp down on these miners. So typically DC is like where you play defense, and the state level is where you play offense. So we're going to stay on offense, keep getting people to join our coalition to fight back and be able to have a positive impact on the state level.
I like it. I got to ask before we keep going, do you have a view on Canadian legislation? Do you know much about Canadian sort of legislative avenues, mechanisms? Are you guys thinking about that at all? Are you hearing anything from your brethren up north?
You know, I do occasionally hear things from our friends to the north, and, you know, I've offered to be helpful where I can. At the end of the day, you know, Canadians have to kind of pull them up selves by their bootstraps and do it on their own. There's just nothing an American really can do. I mean, unless I was in a very powerful position, which I can't say I'm in a powerful position at this point in my life, other than that, I can just be an influential position. So, you know, I would just suggest Canadians just do the same thing that we're doing, like become extremely active in the political space and make yourself known. That is how you have an impact on the way that these people vote. And I think the problem is oftentimes we get a little bit active and we don't get what we want, and then we get upset, and then we say, you know, politics is a scam. So my solution is you need to get way more active, but also here's the thing that's critical. You need to do it in a way where you're playing nice. You play nice 90% of the time. Obviously I don't know, people like Jordan Peterson, sometimes he says some really good stuff, right? He's a Canadian from up north. So he's like, you need to be an animal. Like, you need to be ferocious, but you need to learn to control it. Like, you can't just run into these policymakers and be like screaming at them all the time. They're going to like be like, whoa, you're crazy. So you play nice, you have good relationships, you build good relationships. That's critical. Think of these people like they're part of your community. Don't think of politicians like separate from you. Otherwise, they'll really be separate from you. You want to feel like they're part of your community. You engage with them, you go through the process with them. And then when necessary, you apply pressure, because you know that everyone else is applying pressure in important moments, and you apply that pressure. Sometimes you're going to win, sometimes you're going to lose. But the most important part is that you're in a position to impact the outcome. If you're not, then it's definitely not going to go your way.
No, that's well said. That's very well said. I'm curious, you mentioned working together with politicians there. You've mentioned it a few times. There's a lot of, at the moment, enforcement action floating around the United States, whether it's legitimate or not, whether it's just on some of these, you know, sort of FinTwit accounts with blue check marks. Stuff about XRP, for example, that is still floating. Just before we went live, one of the last tweets I saw before my Twitter went flatline is that the White House is considering a move to ban stuff like staking in the United States from Brian Armstrong. So I'm curious about your view on whether or not we should be, I say we as maximalists. I don't know how you define maximalists. I would count myself as a maxi, even though I have like an equities portfolio, and heaven forbid I, you know, own a shitcoin home as well. But yeah.
Oh my gosh, you know, watch out.
Unbelievable. I know. Sorry. So the thing I'm curious about is, how do you guys view actions against other tokens or networks? Is this an opportunity to dance on graves? Or are these actions chipping away at a sort of a bigger iceberg that Bitcoin occupies? Are these wedges toward regulating Bitcoin in a way that's oppressive, let's say? Or is this something just for us not to worry about at all? No dancing, no concern, no nothing. What do you think?
You know, in some ways, I think part of what you're saying is correct, that there is this, and it's not, I'm not even the person that came up with this, but there's a couple of really popular Bitcoiners. I'll have to go look up the tweets, but they were talking about how the crypto space kind of operates as like a regulatory moat around Bitcoin, and that it distracts legislators and regulators in a way where it keeps them focused on the crypto space. I mean, the crypto space abounds with fraud and with scams. Obviously, I think there's some people, like, I'm not going to say the projects necessarily are legitimate, but the effort and the thought and the care behind the project, I think, is legitimate. And so these people are putting themselves in a way into the arena of the political space, and it is creating quite a bit of distraction. So I'm not one to you know, celebrate when any sort of negative thing occurs. Obviously, when something like FTX collapses or Luna collapses, like, there's a lot of people that are getting hurt in that situation. I think as Bitcoiners, you know, oftentimes we get into this situation where we're like, oh, we rally. We're like, see, we told you so. And that's a great thing. That's a great feeling to have, to like know that you were right. But I don't think it's a great way to like portray ourselves necessarily. You know, Twitter is built for dunks though, so I don't think we'll stop dunking on people anytime soon. I'm well aware of how the dunking system works and how dunking points are acquired, and that it's great for acquiring likes and engagement. So I don't hate on it too bad. I get it, especially because in these bull markets, you know, a lot of these crypto people oftentimes kind of tell Bitcoiners that they're crazy and boomer and they laugh at us. And then, you know, when things turn around, they expect us to be nice, which, you know, we should be kind of holding ourselves to a higher standard and trying to make sure that we have a better decorum. That's what I do with policymakers. That's what I do in the political space. You know, I work alongside other organizations that are not strictly 100% Bitcoin focused. And there's a reason why, because even though they're kind of crypto broadly, they do have a Bitcoin mandate. They do have a Bitcoin mining mandate. Like, they want to work to protect Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining, and they've spent money and resources doing that. So whenever they're focused on Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining, I want to be working alongside them. If they're working on other stuff, you know, that's up to them, and that's their prerogative, and that's up to their donors and their teams. It's not for me to say. One last closing comment there on this part is that there is times very much so when the crypto space and the Bitcoin space are kind of on the same team. And I'm curious to see how those situations play out. We haven't really had any major ones since the broker amendment, but I do suspect that there will be others in the future that will unify the crypto space, you know, alongside the Bitcoin space, in some of these political fights.
Would you say, sort of spreading your idea almost by osmosis? You know, you're near these other organizations, you're working with them, as you mentioned, and then you find they become more Bitcoin friendly. This is typically the way things go in the space. People start out, you know, I know for me, I'm not sure about your background in alts, but I remember in 2017, I was buying all kinds of garbage, whatever had a token and a subreddit, like, I'll throw $100 in there. What's the worst that could happen? And, you know, I think that as I spent more time around Bitcoiners, as you mentioned, the decorum was better. The message and the sort of vision was tighter. I would imagine it's like that for you guys as well, with some of these organizations that work with other networks or other tokens or for other, toward other means. Are you finding that? Are you finding that you're getting good people coming to you from other, you know, tech spaces, other policy spaces, and saying, hey, I like what you guys are doing. I'd like to participate.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. There's, you know, we're getting all sorts of attention from some of the largest political organizations in the entire country are paying attention to what Bitcoiners are doing. I mean, they're paying attention to what Satoshi Action Fund is doing. You know, we had quite a few conversations with some of these pretty large entities in DC. We have ongoing conversations with them as well. You know, we're always trying to find allies in the space. Like, the political arena is always about finding allies that you can work together with. And some of those companies have no sort of interaction with Bitcoin at all. Some are finding their way into the space. And there has been, I will say, there's a few organizations that are some of the most powerful political organizations in the country that are not actual political parties themselves, but they're like organizations. And they are starting to come into the Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining space with a very optimistic eye. So I'm excited about where those conversations are going. There's not much I can share there other than that there's a lot of potential opportunity. And I think the same thing is kind of occurring with some of the crypto groups as well. Like, really one thing I would like to say there is, like, there's these crypto groups, which are like trades, right? And they like kind of protect everything. But oftentimes a lot of the people that I engage with that work for those organizations, like, they have a very, very pro Bitcoin stance. Like, they are not in any way like, you know, oh, we should move to proof of stake, or, oh, you know, this asset is better than Bitcoin. Almost all of them that I talk to are very, very positive on Bitcoin. So that's kind of one of the things that you don't get to see on Twitter so much, because you see these organizations kind of working with so many different camps, but the individuals inside those organizations are extremely pro Bitcoin.
That's good to hear. Now, you're in a position to give some insight here on the nature of the relationship right now between energy companies and large miners, industrial miners. We've heard many times, Dennis, over the last year that certain energy companies are looking to either acquire or begin acquiring or are thinking about merging with small miners, getting their own equipment, whatever. You mentioned the Orphaned Well partnership, for example. There's talk about flared gas. There's been that talk for a long time. And just a general feeling that there's money sitting on the table, Satoshis, in fact, sitting on the table for energy companies. Do you have a view on the relationship going forward between energy companies and Bitcoin mining? Or is that something that, you know, just isn't of concern yet in the space?
Oh, no, it's you know, it's already happening to some degree. You know, we don't know how much is taking place, but what we do know is some pretty exciting news. You have, you know, the obvious one that's been talked about on Twitter a lot today is, you know, Shell Energy is sponsoring the largest Bitcoin conference in the country. Shell Energy also manufactures the immersion cooling liquid that is used for immersion mining. They also, from what I understand, own a company that owns a company. So they have a shell company of a shell company that's owned by shell company that mines Bitcoin. So that's a rumor. I don't know if I can confirm or deny that, but I have heard people mentioning.
Yeah, you know, for a guy who used to do the breaking thing, you're not really breaking anything. There's no all caps breaking here. It's all being parsed very well. You're dancing around a lot of these new breaking headlines. I'm expecting at least one yell breaking here.
Hey, well, you did get breaking news. The policy passed in Mississippi on the Senate side. Also, though, on that energy side of things, you have Talen Energy, which is a very large energy company, a huge nuclear portfolio, and now they're building a 200 megawatt Bitcoin mining facility. They're an energy company. So there you go. There's your energy company getting into Bitcoin mining. You also have Exxon mining Bitcoin with flared gas, and you're starting to see a lot of other small firms, I think, come around. Now, will there be a giant moment when you see this convergence of energy companies and Bitcoin mining? I don't know if that's something that takes place in a short period of time or if it's kind of like a slowly then suddenly sort of thing, because we're definitely in the slowly and then suddenly. Like, it's happening as we speak. You have Duke Energy, you know, studying Bitcoin mining. That's the second largest utility in the entire country studying Bitcoin mining for the purposes of demand response. You have ERCOT is basically all in on Bitcoin mining. Now they were so all in on Bitcoin mining that they're like, wait, maybe we should be careful on how much Bitcoin mining we're bringing to the state. At the end of the day, though, I just think you're going to continue to see this convergence of energy companies and Bitcoin because it doesn't really make sense for energy companies not to mine Bitcoin. This is a piece of grid infrastructure. That's what we tell policymakers. We're like, this is a business that duels as a piece of grid infrastructure that can help you achieve your energy goals. If your energy goals are to decarbonize the grid and to clean up the environment, and to electrify the economy, Bitcoin mining can help you achieve that. If your energy goals are to find new customers to export your energy to because there's just not large high transmission voltage lines, this is a big problem in Montana, then Bitcoin mining can help you solve that. So I just think that this idea that, like, is it going to happen? I mean, it is already happening, but how much will it sort of pick up in speed? And will we see big energy companies buying miners or big miners buying some small energy companies? I suspect that these conversations at a bare minimum are happening, I know they're happening. At what speed will those deals start to actually take place and, you know, become something that is a reality?
I have a keen interest in this. I don't know if you know Ryan McLeod, nuclear Bitcoiner. He's in the chat here talking about SMRs.
Oh,
yeah, huge, right? And so, like, all this stuff is
I forgot to look at the chat.
The synergies are obvious. I mean, it's okay. Yeah. The chat's hard to maintain. I always say to Len when we do the interviews alone, I don't know how the fuck anyone looks at the chat while they're talking to the guest. But anyway, it's a story for another time. Two more questions. One about Bitcoin, and then I got one fun one to get you out of here. You deal in PR. Directly, indirectly, whatever the case is. You are basically the one of the front men for Bitcoin mining, this sort of headless beast that regulators are now staring in the face. When you talk to regulators, you, I'm sure, consider the tone, the message, all that stuff. But I have to be honest with you. I have a concern that especially publicly traded miners are focused on the wrong things. I'm gonna you know, spit out a name here, Hut 8, okay? Hut 8. In the past has decided to go this sort of, let's just say they've chosen what looks good or sounds good on an investor call as opposed to what looks good and sounds good on a bottom line, evidenced by this recent merger they, you know, underwent with, I think, what was it, American Bitcoin or something like that. And so I'm curious, what do you think publicly traded Bitcoin miners are doing right as far as messaging and operations, and what could they be doing better as far as messaging and operations to sort of secure their spot in the United States going forward?
I definitely think that it's pretty interesting and exciting news from Hut 8 acquiring a U.S. Bitcoin, and U.S. Bitcoin is a firm here in America. They've got spots in New York, and I believe in Texas as well, and a couple other sites. I don't know exactly what the long term strategy is there from Jamie Leverton at Hut 8, but at the end of the day, I think they have a pretty smart team. I've spoken to folks from their team a few times, and I don't know what the specific strategy is on why they decided to acquire this firm. They could have some sort of long term view on trying to go through this and maybe other mergers and acquisitions to position themselves to get bought up by an energy company. Like, I ultimately don't know. It's very difficult to kind of read into their motivation, but I think it's exciting news and it's cool to see them kind of progress forward. I'm relatively like their operations, like what they're doing. I tend to, even though I am someone who is a, Bitcoin mining proponent and very much steeped in the Bitcoin mining space, like I don't get into like individual companies and why I think they're amazing or why I don't. Now I might say highlight something that I like for instance, I think CleanSpark has done a really good job of highlighting their, pretty strong nuclear mandate and that they have lots of carbon-free energy that they're producing. I think that's a really enticing story to policymakers. I like that Riot is building, an additional $300 million in a economically depressed zone. Like when you do things like that, like I'm going to know about it. I'm going to talk about it. But when it comes down to like, what's their long-term strategy on mergers and acquisitions and their balance sheet strategy? Like I tend to avoid having a specific opinion on those, not because I think it's bad to have an opinion. I just don't have time to do all the advocacy work and advocate for Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining. And then also kind of on the financial side, like be studying their balance sheet and understanding how like their strategy is going to play out over the long term. Like we don't really know, like maybe this is a bad strategy. Maybe it's a good strategy. I think ultimately the market will decide on that.
Okay. Great interview. Before we give you the handoff and let you talk about where people can find some more about Satoshi Action Fund, the NBA trade deadline is tomorrow, right? Did you know that?
I did not know that.
So okay. Are you a basketball guy? All I want to know is, should the Trailblazers trade Lillard or keep Lillard tomorrow?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I mean, I'm not a big basketball guy, but I'm very much aware of the Lillard drama. That's a tough call. I think you cash out now. I think you cash out now and you try to booster your trades in the draft and reboot the team. Because at this point, it's like we've tried for a long time and we really haven't gotten that far. We haven't even gotten to a championship game. And Lillard has had a lot of good teammates, and I like Lillard, and it's like a sad thing. It's like almost when like Russell Wilson left the Seahawks, like this guy's a, he's a Super Bowl winning champion. Right. And like, you're like trading him away, but it's like, at the end of the day, you have to do what's best for the team. And I think that it's time to move on. I think it could be difficult to do that. Have they decided if they're going to trade him yet or not? Have they made the call?
I have no idea. The NBA is very tight-lipped. There's like two Twitter accounts you can follow that give you all the news about trades. So tomorrow's going to be busy on Twitter if it's working. If it's not working, I don't know where I'm going to look. I'll just have to go on like Yahoo Sports or something. I have no idea.
I love how Twitter's like officially broken now. Like everyone was talking about how it's broken, but it's like, no, it's actually broken right now.
Doesn't work.
We'll see. Last comment too, I want to say about Ryan coming into the chat. I love Ryan. We DM occasionally here and there. But I do. I'm a big fan of SMRs. Huge fan. Man, the chat is so fun. I should have looked here earlier. Why you got to bring up
SMRs, small modular reactors, for people listening, watching, who don't remember that episode that we did with Ryan. We've had him on a couple of times. I love that idea. How much do you guys talk about that, Dennis? You talk about like if Bitcoin is a bridge too far for some policymakers, SMR they get though?
Oh, so yeah. I mean, there's multiple states that are like highly They're deep in talks in like adopting SMR technology.
That is
multiple
sick.
States. That is I mean, sick. One of the states that I'm working with is like doing it simultaneously with Bitcoin mining. Like they want to adopt Bitcoin mining and SMRs like simultaneously.
That's a big win. If you can score that, you can come back on the program and talk to me about how those conversations went.
Thanks, Joey. I appreciate that.
So, okay, before you go, tell people where they can find Satoshi Action Fund. There's a newsletter for sure that I signed up for, but if there's more stuff you want to share, key stuff coming up, what's in the pipeline, it's all you, buddy.
Yeah, man. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you for having me on the show. You can go to satoshiaction.io and you can sign up for our newsletter. If you like the work that we're doing, you know, we're always looking for folks that want to become monthly subscribers or monthly supporters of our work. Feel free to do so. Every single dollar, every single dime goes towards spreading the good word of Satoshi and trying to convince policymakers that Bitcoin mining is in fact very positive and good thing for the world. But yeah, that's where you can find me. I'm on Twitter all the time too, when it's not broken. But reach out to me anytime, man. I mean, I'm pretty much an open book. I have open DMs still, so feel free to reach out. And if you have any questions, comments about Satoshi Action, we're doing a dinner too. If you happen to be going to Empower, Empower is the mining meets energy conference in Houston. It's on March 8th and 9th, and you can get tickets 10% off. Use code SAF if you don't have one. But if you want to go to the dinner, reach out to me and I can push that invite over to you. If you happen to be in Houston on the 9th of March for the conference or for whatever reason, hit me up. Should be a pretty good time.
Killer. Dennis Porter. Thanks, brother. Thanks everyone for listening and watching, and we'll see you soon. Well done. Way to go. That